at your conference table or your tailgate spot. We bring the know-how, we got a lot. Local experts with a digital plan. Woo! We'll boost your biz with a helping hand. Ready? Reading online marketing, we're right here.
Okay. From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
He came from 0% asterisk in the polls at the beginning of the 76 cycle to being inaugurated as the 39th president in 18 months. Mm-hmm. Politically, it was a work of genius, but all the genius deserted him after he was elected.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Stephen Hayward, professor at Pepperdine, senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute, and author of The Real Jimmy Carter. Later on in today's program, we talk in depth with Stephen about the Carter legacy. First, we're joined by Dr. Miles Smith, assistant professor of history here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Smith, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for letting me be on, Scott.
Talking today about an essay you had published over at Real Clear Defense, Navy has a cultural crisis. And you open by saying that the U.S. Navy is adrift strategically, culturally, and spiritually. So what the heck's gone wrong over there?
Well, I think that militaries need an identity. I'm writing a lot on the military right now. We started a military history center here at the college. So if our listeners don't know that, it's really cool. Come out and participate in some of the events. So I think that what's happened is the Navy for a long time kind of understood itself as this kind of defender of a Western liberal democratic republic that was largely predicated on Judeo-Christian values. And that sounds like something you would take for granted, but I don't think that that's necessarily been what the Navy, not just the Navy, but the militaries have thought they were doing. And because of that, I think you've seen strategic ossification. We're not really sure what it's there for. Even an idea of the freedom of the seas, which comes from Great Britain, has kind of gotten lost. So what's the Navy for? Obviously, it's huge. It's expensive. It's powerful. And Americans pay for all of those things. Mm-hmm. They pay for the hugeness and the powerfulness of the U.S. Navy. So they might ask, okay, all I ever hear about is you guys are running into each other, right? There's a series of mishaps over the last couple of years. Those seem to be dying down, thank goodness. And so I think there's a sense where the Navy sort of needed to recapture what it was really about. And I think that's happened, by the way. The new CNO, Admiral Caudle, is, I think, by disposition, a relatively conservative man. He's from near where I grew up. He has a strong Southern accent. He was reared in a Southern Baptist church. So he's kind of one of these OG kind of American type guys who really believes in what you kind of think of the good old fashioned mom and pop style military establishment. And I think that's a good thing. And so I think in a lot of ways, even since I've written the article, important changes have been made. The military is meeting its recruiting goals. But I think there had to be some sort of shift away. I won't call it the Biden era military because it's bigger than the Biden era, but there had to be some change.
Looking at the importance of the Navy, do Americans kind of take our maritime dominance and, in fact, maritime peace for granted? What's at stake when we talk about this?
Yeah, we definitely take it for granted. The U.S. Navy is the single most powerful maritime force that's ever existed. Each of our carrier groups is the size of a medium European Navy. And so we have, hopefully, we have the capability to put 12 of them to sea. Usually there's only about 6 or 7 of them at sea at any one time. Right now it's more like 4. And so our Navy is really powerful, but I think what we do is we take for granted that superiority. You have to maintain that. Naval thinkers throughout history understand it's something you have to choose. We kind of get a little bit, we sit back, rest on our laurels, and forget that a country like China wants to challenge us. And so if anything, it's a little bit like the end of the 19th century where Britain mm-hmm. had this massive navy and Germany decided to challenge it. Now, they can never get quite parity, but they put up a pretty good fight. And so I think the United States is clear thinking, we don't want that to even get to where Germany was in 1914, challenging Britain. We would much rather have a navy that can overpower pretty much any and all comers. In the 19th century, that meant the British Navy wanted to be twice as big
right.
as the two biggest navies after it.
You quote a warning here in the piece at Real Clear Defense that Navy leadership is sleepwalking into defeat. What's wrong with the way that senior leaders are being chosen or thinking about their jobs?
I think some of it's a philosophy of history question. When was the last time there were major naval battles? Probably in World War II.
Uh-huh.
Right. So there just hasn't been anything. It's been 80 years, right? It's been a healthy human lifetime since there's been significant ship-to-ship combat. There's a broad belief amongst late 20th century naval thinkers that aircraft carriers have fundamentally reshaped navies, that we don't need raw tonnage. There's a lot of people who in the past 5 years have said, no, that's wrong. Just raw tonnage does matter. China is building more raw tonnage, has a capability of outweighing the U.S. Navy considerably. There's only about 87, I think since 1980, 87% of our shipbuilding capacity is gone. So this is something that you probably need to take seriously if you're an American, that if you want China to control the world's oceans,
mm-hmm.
we should keep doing what they're doing. I don't want that. I don't think that the President of the United States want that. I don't think the American High Command wants that. And so hopefully policymakers will make changes in order to keep that from being the case.
You write here that there's a spiritual problem inside the Navy as well, not just a strategic problem. What do you mean by that, and how does that manifest itself inside the institution?
Yeah, I think that the United States Navy is the United States Navy. It's not just merely some sort of Gnostic bureaucracy that gets put on top of ships, right? There's culture that comes with it. There's beliefs that come with it. In the end of the 19th century, there was this kind of assumption that, hey, we Westerners actually are superior and we need to act like that. And that's kind of a dirty thing to say. Now, luckily I work for Hillsdale College, so I don't think Dr. Arnn's going to fire me for saying that the Western political and intellectual and spiritual tradition is the superior one. But even military thinkers thought that. And so it wasn't to exclude people who weren't Westerners. It was to invite them in. And so Western navies and Western militaries kind of presented themselves to East Asian countries at the time as models to be emulated, not enemies to fight against. And so it kind of works, right? The Japan, Korea, China much later start to actually ape Western military norms. And for the most part, it's good for those countries. In the case of Japan, you might say it's too good. Mm-hmm. Right? They begin to really act. They want to be like Germany and Britain. And so nonetheless, like, there's a reason for that sort of superior edge. It's almost like navies had swagger. Western navies had swagger back then. And that swagger is kind of important. It's not very popular to talk about that kind of era superiority, but it's important. It's important for the U.S. Navy to have that over and against, especially the communist Chinese sure. military, which they don't even call it the Navy, by the way. It's the People's Liberation Army Navy.
Dr. Miles Smith with us, Assistant Professor of History here at Hillsdale, his piece at Real Clear Defense on the Navy. You draw on Alfred Thayer Mahon, a 19th century naval strategist, still influencing thinking today. What lessons from him do we need to relearn?
That sea power is actually what controls the world. His famous book is called The Influence of Sea Power on World History. 1662 to 1789. And so you have a real sense of controlling the world's seas is how a given country kind of controls its own fate. Whoever is able to control the seas basically controls the world. Now, this is different than some of the military theories that kind of have anybody who controls the Eurasian landmass actually controls history or something like that. Mahon thought that if you had a big navy, you were going to run the show. And he goes through world powers like Britain and the Dutch, for example. Holland's this tiny little country, and yet it has outsized influence in the world. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it has a huge navy. Same thing with Britain. Britain, even in some ways, exponentially more powerful than the Dutch ever were. But Great Britain's not that big. The whole island's smaller than Colorado, and it commanded a fourth of the world's land surface by 1900. So you get the feeling that navies actually matter, and Mahan realizes this for the United States. We had kind of settled into being okay with being this continental power, and Mahan says, no, that's not good enough. Because, believe it or not, we can't control our continent unless we can control the oceans around.
Dr. Miles Smith with us from Hillsdale College. We talk more with him in just a moment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Indulge in an unforgettable evening at Turtle Bay's Chocolate After Dark.
Taking place two separate nights, Thursday, February 5th and Friday, February 6th, from 6 to 9 p.m.
at Turtle Bay Museum in Reading. Enjoy delicious chocolate treats, fine local wines,
live music, and a fun night out. Perfect for date night or a special treat for you and your friends.
This 21 and over event is too sweet to miss and sure to sell out.
Chocolate After Dark at Turtle Bay Museum, February 5th and 6th.
Buy tickets online at turtlebay.org.
Mandiva's Cabinets, the local pros.
Mandiva's Cabinets in Anderson designs custom kitchens, bathrooms, and offices that no big box store can match. They are the local pros who know.
Mandiva's Cabinets, the local pros who know. Mandiva's Cabinets, the local pros.
530-365-8108 or visit mandivascabinets.com.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with departments staffed with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is Financial Advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number, 530-244-7199.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
When you have a workers' compensation case, the insurance companies and adjusters are not on your side. Speak with an attorney to be sure you're not missing out on the benefits that you need and are entitled to. Workers' compensation is complicated. Gorman Law can help you turn a bad situation into a new opportunity. Call us at 530-262-2168, 530-262-2168, or schedule a free consultation online at gormancomplaw.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to follow the Hillsdale College Podcast Network on X at HC Podcasts. We're there at Hillsdale Radio for updated show and guest information. Talking with Dr. Miles Smith from here at Hillsdale College, his piece over at Real Clear Defense, U.S. Navy's Cultural Crisis. Dr. Smith, we had just talked about Alfred Mahad, a 19th century naval strategist, still influencing thinking today.
Mahad linked strategy to a sense of Western and Christian moral confidence. As a more secular, more pluralistic America now, can we still have that kind of moral grounding in our strategic outlook?
Yeah, I think secularism at its best is actually an outgrowth of Christianity. Right, secularism is really just a statement that churches don't need to control everything. Of course, you can have Judeo-Christian Western values without them sort of being perpetuated by a specific church. And so I think at its best, of course, we don't need a kind of theocracy or anything to perpetuate the superiority of the West or to sort of maintain Western superiority. We just have to believe in that tradition. I think that it's something as simple as I don't need every sailor to go to church. You know, guys, go have fun, play video games, get all your tattoos, go to B-dubs on the weekend. You know, no one wants to make these guys, you know, church boys or choir boys. But at the same time, they should kind of know the world they're fighting for. Like, what type of freedoms, what type of liberties, what type of place you want to be able to come back to. And so it's just as simple as that. Like, I want guys to be able to know that, hey, you know how it's cool to go buy whatever video games we want or go out to eat. All those little are actually downstream from Judeo-Christian values because Chinese people can't do all those things. And people in totalitarian countries can't do all those things.
Talking with Dr. Miles Smith, his piece at Real Clear Defense on the Navy and its cultural crisis. You say that logistics is the key to victory in the Pacific. What's our biggest shortfall in that department? And what would it take to fix it before a potential real crisis with China?
The Sealift Command. It's not as big per capita as it once was. I lived in Norfolk, Virginia for a long time, and so you can see all the ships coming in and out. The U.S. Navy's aging. We don't build as many ships as we used to. It takes us a long time to refit a ship. And so some of it is just the raw numbers of hulls we put together. It takes us a long time to do that compared to, for example, the PRC, which does it fairly quickly. It doesn't mean they're putting together good ships, but it does mean at some point three or four bad ships can actually put a dent in a military situation. And so I think that that's something significant to think about, our ability to get the stuff we need to as fast as possible, as efficiently as possible in craft that are seaworthy and superior. Is something to think about. And I think those things are being addressed slowly but surely. It'll take us a couple of years to actually see what happens on the ground.
We can see by actions that clearly China wants to establish itself or elevate itself as a naval power. How do you assess that challenge posed by China's Navy presently? Are they already ahead of us in areas that we should be concerned about?
No. But we should want to keep it that way. I think that there's a lot of, especially on the right, there's a lot of sort of, you know, hand-wringing about China's superiority. China's not superior to us. Their aircraft carriers are basically what we would think of as 1970s technology. We're way ahead of them, but we should really fight to stay ahead of them. And I think that that's what is kind of concerning. Do we have the willpower to maintain our superiority over a country like the PRC? Do we have the willpower to push them around a little bit? Interestingly enough, Argentina seems to be willing to do this. Argentina regularly is sort of pushing out at least small Chinese support craft from Argentine waters. And it'd be interesting to see what other countries are willing to do that.
We talk a lot about the U.S. and China, obviously. Who are the other naval powers we should know about around the world?
Japan is probably one that is going to start, not saber rattling in a nefarious sense, but it's going to make sure, especially with the new prime minister coming in, she's very much a China hawk. She wants to reestablish Japan's naval superiority in the Sea of Japan and in Japan's kind of broader sphere of influence. Other players in the region, Australia, Malaysia, Thailand, but probably for our purposes, the single most important one is one that doesn't even really have a stake in this, India. Big, giant navy, a well-trained navy, a professional Western-style navy, but one that isn't reflexively in either the camp of the United States or China.
So why are the oceans of such vital importance to the peace and prosperity of both the U.S. and the global community? Why should we be so concerned about this?
Well, because, I mean, shipping is the lifeblood of the world's commerce. Obviously, we have airplanes. Airplanes are great, but if you've ever lived near a big ship and lived near a big airplane, you know that ships are a lot bigger than airplanes.
Uh-huh.
One of my favorite things to do is when I lived in Norfolk, get people to just go over the battleship, the USS Wisconsin. It's huge. It's 900 feet long, just under 900 feet long. You know, it's 150 feet wide, and you're going, good grief, this is huge. And now imagine freight ships that are even bigger than that. A battleship, a World War II battleship, is nowhere near as big as modern freighters are. So we can just ship a lot of stuff, and actually you can move over water fairly efficiently, too. And so I think that oceans are still kind of the lifeblood of world commerce. We ship cars. There's things you can't ship in airplanes.
Right.
And so cars, big containers, stuff like that, all of that stuff needs maritime commerce. And so whoever is controlling the world's ocean, you want them to have as broad a view of that commerce as possible. And totalitarian regimes just can't do that. It's not in their nature to want the freedom of the seas for free exchange of goods. And so that's why I think the United States should be the country that controls the world's oceans.
Are we a little more cognizant of that based on what we've seen in the Middle East, shipping channels there, problems of the past 12, 18 months?
Yeah, the Houthis in Yemen closing down the southern interchange points in the Red Sea. You don't want a powerless United States Navy because you want to be able to remove rogue players who would shut down the world's major shipping points. The Sunda Strait is another one. You can think about, you want obviously NATO controlling the North Sea, NATO controlling the areas in and around Iceland. So I think that this is why NATO is controversial. So I think a lot of Americans are like, well, why do we have it?
Mm-hmm.
Europe's so weird, right? And I get that. Like, I totally agree. But one thing that's useful about NATO is that it's more than just a bunch of land units facing Russia, right? It's also major Western navies who, for all of their government's problems, all seem to be invested in maintaining the freedom of the seas.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good thing. You want those 27, 28 navies all doing that. So as goofy as their countries may be, whatever people might think about the Russia-Ukraine conflict, you really want these big Western navies maintaining the freedom of the seas.
Dr. Miles Smith, Assistant Professor of History here at Hillsdale College. You can find his piece about the Navy's cultural crisis over at Real Clear Defense. Dr. Smith, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks, Scott.
Up next, Stephen Hayward joins us. He wrote the book, The Real Jimmy Carter, and we discuss Carter's legacy, specifically on the economic side of things. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. Have you been affected by some of the recent changes in business ownership here in Shasta and Tehama counties? These changes follow a national trend where national companies buy up locally owned small family companies and change the culture and staff and pricing of their product. That has occurred here in the North State also. Three locally owned propane companies have been purchased by large national companies. If you're like me and you prefer to deal with locally owned companies, you may be interested to know Shasta Gas Propane, which has been around for 28 years, now has the third generation working in the company. For locally owned, family operated service and care, give us a call at 530-365-3793. Thank you.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
Ready to boost your learning and earning potential? Shasta College can help. Full-time students may qualify for 2 years of free tuition to jumpstart a high-demand career. Pressed for time? We get it. That's why we offer 8-week compressed, cohort-based, and online or hybrid classes designed for busy adults. Spring classes start January 21st, so now's the perfect time to plan your next step. For more information, contact ShastaCollege.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. Do it at podcast.hillsdale.edu. You can find all of our shows wherever you find your audio, including at YouTube. We're joined by Stephen F. Hayward. He's professor of public policy at Pepperdine University, senior fellow at Pacific Research Institute, and the author of the book, The Real Jimmy Carter, How Our Worst Ex-President Undermines American Foreign Policy, Coddles Dictators, and Created the Party of Clinton and Kerry. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Scott.
People might pick up on the title of the book. Right. It was written about 20 years ago.
Right.
You're here on Hillsdale's campus now as part of our CCA lecture series and delivering a lecture on the Carter economy, essentially. And today we'll talk about deregulation, stagflation, malaise, and all things Jimmy Carter. The big picture, though, when we talk about the Carter years and the Carter presidency, what comes to your mind first? If someone didn't live through the Carter years, how would you describe that era?
Yeah, it's nearly 50 years ago now since he was first elected. And it's really quite amazing that there was one historian who said this was the closest America ever came to picking a name out of the phone book and making him president. I mean, no one had heard of this guy. He came from 0%, an asterisk in the polls at the beginning of the 76 cycle to being inaugurated as the 39th president in 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
Politically, and this is just a phenomenon of running for president, it was a work of genius. But all the genius deserted him after he was elected. And so I think what most people remember who were alive then was that's when stagflation got out of control, and it was kind of the end of the road for liberal economics. We had both high inflation and high unemployment at the same time. which classical Keynesian theory said you couldn't have and could be easily fixed by turning the knobs of the fine-tuning instruments. And then we had the second inning, I like to say, of the energy crisis. Mm-hmm. And there was no energy crisis. It was a government policy crisis. But Carter took a bad situation and made it all worse.
For average everyday Americans in the late 1970s, what was life like for them dealing with gas lines and dealing with things that had not previously dealt with in decades?
Right. Well, there are two things really stick out from people from the time, and I tell students about it sometimes, and they find it hard to believe. But yeah, we had to line up for gasoline in the lot of the summer of 1979, 4 or 5 in the morning, and that's because the gas stations would stop selling gas by about 10 in the morning, and they limited you to 10 gallons mm-hmm. in most cases. In other words, we had gasoline rationing, just by making you wait in line instead of by price or coupons or something. And this was all madness. It takes a long time to unravel. But the other thing was inflation. Everyone nowadays is used to either shopping online or with barcodes.
Uh-huh.
But in late 70s at the grocery stores, you still had stickers.
Yes.
On you know, peanut butter jars and all the items. And, you know, that was a big job then for a teenage kid was the stock boy would go around and put the stickers on every single jar, every single box of cereal. And my mother, who did the shopping in my house, would come home and she would start peeling off the stickers. In other words, you would sometimes have 3 or 4 stickers piled on top of one another with a higher price for something that had only been on the shelf for maybe a month or less,
like, yep.
you know, peanut butter and jelly and things of that kind. That really brought it home to people when you could see prices rising almost in real time in your week-to-week grocery shopping.
Talking with Stephen Hayward here on Hillsdale's campus about Jimmy Carter and the Carter economy. Stagflation, high inflation, high unemployment together. You mentioned it wasn't supposed to be possible. So why was it possible? How did it happen, and why was it hard to fix?
Oh, right. That's a really important story. One of the reasons it happened, well, high monetary growth is what leads to inflation. I mean, Milton Friedman won his Nobel Prize, I think it was 1976, and his theories weren't at that time widely accepted. They were still, they're still controversial today with some people on the left, but monetary growth had just run out of control in the Carter years. It was, you know, over 10% a year in basic monetary growth, and that's too high. And Carter finally figured that out by 1979. I mean, you know, Friedman, other monetarists, their ideas caught on by 1979, and that's when Carter reversed course, appointed Paul Volcker as chair of the Federal Reserve, and began the long, because it is always long, and painful process of bringing inflation down. But the other reason you had the swoon in employment and job creation was because taxes were too high, especially in an era of inflation. So it was in the middle of Carter's term that you had the beginning of supply-side economics. It was the Kemp-Roth tax cut, which Carter vigorously opposed, said it was a giveaway. All the cliches we hear now, giveaway to the rich, tax cut for millionaires, and so forth. And, you know, today we're so used to venture capital and startups out of Silicon Valley and elsewhere, and there was almost none of that happening. And so the tax cut passed Congress by large bipartisan majorities. Even liberals, some, could see the logic of you can't have 50% taxes on capital gains. One of the persons who voted for that tax cut in the Senate was a first-term senator from Delaware named Joe Biden. Even he could figure it out back then. And lo and behold, in the first year after the tax cut passed in 1978, Carter relented on his threat to veto it because he was going to lose a veto override. Venture capital activity soared about 15-fold. Capital gains tax revenue went up, proving the famous Laffer curve that if you lower rates, especially on a discretionary thing like, you know, when you take capital gains to how you invest, it's productive for the economy. And of course, that really was the spark that sets the boom of the 80s when you had huge job growth, huge startups, and so forth.
Stephen Hayward with us as we talk about Jimmy Carter's economic legacy. When it comes to deregulation, it might surprise people that this liberal Democrat started the wave of deregulation. So why was he motivated to do so? I find it hard to believe it was because of his free market, you know, beliefs. What motivated Carter to go about this deregulation?
Well, there was a lot of people around him who figured out that we were over-regulating or shouldn't be regulating at all certain basic industries, especially transportation and later a little bit energy in a certain way. But transportation, airlines, and deregulation, they said it's crazy to still be having the federal government setting trucking rates and airline airfares, which they were doing very aggressively. And It was a long story. I love telling students about what really, I think, broke the dam was when Southwest Airlines was founded in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was intrastate, just operating in Texas, they were immune from federal rate setting. I interviewed the president of it back then, Herb Kelleher, one of the founders. He said, our competition wasn't the other airlines. It was Greyhound.
Uh-huh.
And people looked up and said, well, wait a minute. You know, and then you had other competitive airlines joined in. In California, you had Pacific Southwest Airlines just operating L.A. and to San Francisco, very cheap fares. And so someone said, you know, why don't we let the marketplace set airfares? And also, the trucking is a more complicated and amusing story. And some of his own people and some Democrats, you know, the principal legislation to decontrol trucking was worked out by Ted Kennedy, of all people. His staff person who did all the analytical work, a young Harvard law graduate named Stephen Breyer. So even liberals could see that that old school regulation needed to go. On the other hand, during the 70s, you had a huge upswing in social regulation. So while we were starting to back away from sort of New Deal-style market regulation, we now had, you know, the EPA, the Consumer Product Safety Commission. The Carter administration was all in on that.
Mm-hmm.
They thought about proposing a whole cabinet-level Department of Consumer Affairs, which would have been a regulatory Naderite nightmare. But then there's something in between, on not really social regulation, but Carter, who was a teetotaling Southern Baptist, decontrolled or deregulated beer brewing.
Yes.
And the whole you know, brew pub explosion we've all enjoyed the last few decades, we can thank Jimmy Carter for that, believe it or not.
So, why did he stop there? Or why did the administration stop there if they were seeing success in deregulation of certain industries?
Confusion, right. I mean, there were a number of people who said, you know, the energy market was heavily regulated. It still is in certain ways in electric utilities. But oil and gas were regulated, both prices, and we had these allocation quotas that were Byzantine. And Carter agreed in principle, yes, we ought to deregulate, but he was worried that, well, oil companies might make too much money.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, let's deregulate the price, but let's have a windfall profits tax. This made no sense at all. And so all their decontrol impulses were only half measures. It didn't really get changed until literally day one of the Reagan administration. One of the first things he did, first day in office, was completely decontrol the price of oil in the country. Liberals said gas is going to go to $2 a gallon. It was then about $1.25. Instead, the price of gas immediately fell below $1 and stayed there for most of the 1980s.
Stephen Hayward wrote the book The Real Jimmy Carter, also senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute. We will continue our conversation next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Charlu's Tap House in Anderson, where tradition, taste, and togetherness come to life. Warm up with our made-from-scratch soups and signature family sauces, crafted from cherished recipes passed down through generations. Watch the magic happen when we hand-toss every pizza to order, then bake it to perfection. Crispy, cheesy, and made with love. Let the little ones explore our brand-new adventure room with bounce houses, arcade games, and even a make-your-own pizza table where the kids can make their own pizza. Charlu's Tap House in Anderson, where tradition, taste, and togetherness come to life.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew and this month's Cigar of the Humidor, Rocky Patel Emerald. Coming in at number 6 on Cigar Aficionado's Top 25 with a 95 rating, this box-pressed cigar offers great combustibility, a smooth draw, and delicate flavors of ground coffee, hickory, leather, and spice. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
To the area to research and try and find the legend. Just keep it to pictures as proof. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Stephen Hayward is with us on campus here at Hillsdale College. He's professor at Pepperdine, also author of the book The Real Jimmy Carter. We continue to talk about Carter's legacy. Stephen, mostly on the economy here, but a little foreign policy as well, as we talk about the malaise speech and energy in the country. I was just telling my students about this. We're not familiar with the malaise speech at all, but the word malaise is never uttered by Jimmy Carter in the malaise speech. I believe it was confirmed by a spokesman after the fact. Said, could we call it the malaise speech? Yeah, I think you could. So it's now the malaise speech, but it's the crisis of confidence speech that Jimmy Carter gives. Why did that speech strike such a nerve, and did it reveal certain things about his presidency?
Right. Yeah, so that speech was given in the middle of the summer of 1979, in the middle of the gasoline crisis. And everyone thought it was going to be a speech of what we're going to do about this crisis. And Carter, it's a strange story. He disappeared for about 2 weeks to Camp David before the speech. He canceled the first scheduled date for it. And then when he came back, Americans tuned in large numbers. What are we going to do about these gas lines and, you know, all the other things that go along with it, inflation? Instead, he spent most of the speech talking about a crisis of confidence in the American soul. And one of the things that struck you so odd about this was a year before, Alexander Solzhenitsyn had given his famous Harvard commencement address, where he said similar things about too much materialism in America, a loss of belief, and the Carter administration vigorously criticized that speech. Mm-hmm. And now they were saying something very similar to it. And it turned out that the story about the speech is kind of Byzantine also, but he was much taken with the sociologist Christopher Lash, an interesting theorist, and he used the word malaise to describe America in the 70s. I think there is a certain aspect in which the speech really does capture the mood of the 70s in some ways, but coming from a president from whom he wanted action steps, it landed with a thud. So it's now malaise forever. I do tell students in the words, famous words of Yogi Berra, you have to see it not to believe it.
Uh-huh.
People should watch it on YouTube. And I've shown it to students today, and they're usually their jaws drop.
This crisis of confidence that Carter talks about, you know, gas lines, and you have New York City in the late 70s, which is a total mess and a complete disaster. And you look overseas, the Iran hostage crisis is playing out at this point, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. There's a sense of just pessimism, whether it be domestic or foreign, among Americans from coast to coast. How does all that come together to create the sense of this crisis?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the one sentence summary of the malaise speech, which connects to foreign policy, is remember that Carter ran for president in 1976 on the slogan, a government as good as the people. And in that speech in the summer of 79, he was essentially saying the people are no good.
Mm-hmm.
And so that wasn't lost on people. Overseas, he came to office saying we need to get over our inordinate fear of communism. And he was all for detente. He was all for arms control. And then suddenly the Soviet Union is getting very frisky. They invade Afghanistan. And then suddenly Carter says, oh, wait a minute, these people are bad. Yeah. He reversed course and announced the Carter Doctrine, that any Soviet move in the Middle East will be an attack on America, increase the defense budget. So it showed that, like regulation, he was capable of learning just very slowly.
Mm-hmm. selling students, as we talked about this crisis of confidence speech, that there was a sense among some pundits, analysts, that the presidency was becoming far too big for one person. We can't look at Carter. Carter's a governor, Southern governor. We all liked him. We voted for him. Even he can't handle all the dude. And see, we need two presidents. I mean, certainly you'd need to have a constitutional amendment, all these things. But how serious was this conversation saying, We need change. We need more than one person to run this country.
Well, there are a variety of reform ideas, but that was a very serious conversation. You can go back and look at the literature and in leading academic journals, Time Magazine, things of that kind, elite media. And they all said, and take the long story arc, they said, we now have four failed presidencies in a row. You know, Johnson ends in disaster with Vietnam and the Great Society. Nixon gives us Watergate. Ford was a placeholder but wasn't reelected. And then Carter, we thought the smart person trained in engineering can't cope with this, and the presidency's too big. And so, yeah, have more than one president, have members of Congress be cabinet members like in a parliamentary system, have a single six-year term. That was a popular idea. All these would have required, or most of them, a constitutional amendment. And that is, in fact, I always say the most significant achievement of Ronald Reagan was proving that the presidency was not an obsolete institution, and that, in fact, a person could govern effectively and maintain the support of the American people. And I think almost all of Reagan's successors have demonstrated that. We've had several two-term presidents since then. You know, the ups and downs and the usual controversies, but they did manage to govern effectively.
Stephen Hayward with us. His book, The Real Jimmy Carter, How Our Worst Ex-President Undermines American Foreign Policy, Coddles Dictators, and Created the Party of Clinton and Kerry. As I mentioned, this book is about 20 years old.
Right.
But the sentiment remains, especially around Jimmy Carter's passing. We heard a lot of people say, you know, he might not have been the best president we ever had, but as an ex-president, he was outstanding. He was great post-presidency. Why are they wrong?
Yes, well, there's two or three reasons. One is, of course, he helped build up Habitat for Humanity. He didn't found that, but he lent his celebrity to it and built it up, and that's a good thing. He led a crusade in the developing world to eliminate Guinea worm disease, which is a terrible disease. Props to him for that. But as an ex-president, he was constantly meddling in foreign policy. You know, he had his Carter Center in Atlanta, and he was sort of running his own private State Department. He'd have Soviet officials down to meet and talk about arms control. He was constantly undercutting President Reagan in the Middle East and elsewhere. And the ultimate interference came in the first Gulf War in 1991. Carter was actively calling around to leaders in the Middle East saying, you should not cooperate with President George H.W. Bush's coalition to oust Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. The Bush administration learned of this from, you know, diplomats in the Middle East and were shocked that an ex-president would so actively insert himself into a world crisis of this kind. I mean, of course, presidents are not a normal private citizen, but still, any private citizen who did that, say Bill Gates or Elon Musk or somebody, would risk prosecution under the Logan Act, a little enforced act from the beginning of the Republic. So he did a lot of things like that that call into question his judgment, his self-regard, and several other less appealing traits of his character.
Following Jimmy Carter's presidency, Ronald Reagan takes office for two terms.
Right.
And after the first 2 years, when there's some fits and starts as policies begin to take effect, really turns the country around, both in terms of literal economic performance, but also there's no more crisis of confidence.
Right.
How would you contrast how Carter attempted to deal with America's problems with how Reagan actually dealt with America's problems? What can we say about the two styles of leadership?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, Reagan reacted very harshly to the Malley speech when it was given. And I think he put his finger on it. He said something along the lines of, you know, a speech like that is really expressing the defects of our leader and not of the American people. And Reagan's disposition, starting with his, I think, fabulous first inaugural address was, you, the people, are where the solution to the country's problems lie. And you're great people. And you've always been capable of great things. We're going to get off your back and help you when we can and get out of the way when we can't. And remember, Reagan's reelection campaign in 1984, the slogan was, "It's morning in America." I think there's some reasons to criticize that in some ways, but in other ways, it did capture the rapidly turning mood of the country. We forgot about the dreariness of the 70s really fast.
The book, again, talks about how Carter helped create the party of Clinton and Kerry. We're past that a little bit at this point. How would you describe, or what would be Carter's now really long-term right. effect on the shape of the Democratic Party.
Well, he was a transitional figure, I put it that way, between the old Democratic Party, which still existed in the 70s, and today's, I say, new Democratic Party, which is pretty far to the progressive left. And Carter had some conservative instincts or inclinations that were kind of fuzzy at times. But I'd like to say that, you know, the verdict of the 1972 election, to borrow my old mentor Stan Evans' line, was that government is best which governs least, mm-hmm. one of his great witticisms. And the problem was is that McGovern captured the heart and soul of the Democratic Party, just not the voters. Carter understood that. He barely won in 76. After all the scandals with Republicans, he barely eked into office, which showed the country was trending to the right, I think. And what happened was is that, you know, Carter was a disaster for Democrats, as we know. And ever since then, all the Democrats have either been from the aggressive left, like Obama, or they have concealed their leftism. Mm-hmm. That would have been Clinton. You know, Kerry, of course, lost. And certainly Joe Biden, who, as I said, was, you know, a moderate to conservative Democrat in the 70s, and as president, sold out completely to the progressive left of his party.
Stephen Hayward, he is a professor of public policy at Pepperdine, also senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute. His book, The Real Jimmy Carter, here on Hillsdale's campus, giving a lecture as part of our CCA lecture series. You can find that full lecture at freedomlibrary.hillsdale.edu. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Well, thank you, Scott. I enjoy listening in to you guys now and then.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Miles Smith from Hillsdale College and Stephen Hayward from Pepperdine and the Pacific Research Institute. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, and this month's Cigar of the Humidor, Rocky Patel Emerald. Coming in at number 6 on Cigar Aficionado's Top 25 with a 95 rating, this box-pressed cigar offers great combustibility, a smooth draw, and delicate flavors of ground coffee, hickory, leather, and spice. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Shasta Lake and neighboring friends, the Queen of Dragons has your back with premium products at prices that work for you. As the longest standing dispensary in the area, our local team knows exactly what you need. Our shelves are stocked with the freshest flower in town. From our premium, fresh, and local line to our budget-friendly options featuring Emerald Junkies and Tricana Boys. Don't miss our famous Flower Friday deals. Top quality at unbeatable prices. And for the green thumbs out there, clones are now in store for the growing season. Join our Dragons Reward program and earn points with every purchase. Stop by 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake or call us for delivery at 530-276-9771 or check out our menu at thequeenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons. Premium offerings. Unbeatable value just for you.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with department staff with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is financial advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number, 530-244-7199.
What does comfort mean to you? At Alliance Heating and Air, we understand your HVAC system is the most important system in your home, affecting everything from air quality to temperature control. That's why everybody calls us, delivering perfect comfort. Invest in year-round comfort with an Alliance tune-up for just $99. Plus, we offer comprehensive maintenance plans starting at $15.95 per month. Remember, everybody calls us at 22-12-642.
Everybody calls us.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew and this month's Cigar of the Humidor, Rocky Patel Emerald.
coming in at number 6 on Cigar Aficionado's Top 25 with a 95 rating. This box-pressed cigar offers great combustibility, a smooth draw, and delicate flavors of ground coffee, hickory, leather, and spice. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Redding by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.